Sitting here talking about, a starting gravity of 1162, which sounds just out there. Right, guys? I mean, what do you think? You know, 1162, it's like, okay, I'm going to sugar the yeast to death, you know? But anyway, that's a little bit of pre-show talk we were having here tonight. Welcome to the Mead House. This is a show for home mead makers who want to make good mead at home. That's kind of where it all starts. That's where it starts for us. And Aaron Martin joining us tonight. Mississippi Chris Spencer standing upright, finally. Got that full leg cast thing going on with some kind of a brace. Going right, Chris?
Yep, weight bearing.
Yep. And after how many weeks of sitting in a chair?
Too many. I lost count.
Doesn't that get old?
It gets old, and hobbling around now, so.
Yeah. Jeff Shout in the house. And of course, me, J.D. Webb, here at the Mead House. And I think that pretty much covers everybody. Aaron Martin. Did I mention Aaron Martin?
You did.
I believe so.
You know, You guys got to cut me some slack. I just came, I spent like 12 hours behind the wheel yesterday coming home from our trip up north to the rodeo in Oakdale. And I'm still like beat. We just kind of lollygagged our way home and did a little honey shopping on the way, which I'll tell you about here in a little while. It's kind of a crack up. Chris already knows about it. But to get the show started here tonight, big shout out to Brett Tennant, who's going to join us a little bit later on in the show. Caught him on a Facebook page, the Mead Group. He's doing a chocolate mead. Now, normally I wouldn't really, chocolate. I can take it or leave it, mostly leave it. But then I read in this whole posting, there's a couple of people involved. One of them said that he actually took some oak cubes and soaked them in bourbon. So I kind of sat right up in my chair and started paying attention. So Brett Tennant's going to join us here in about a half hour or so. We do have an app for that. You can download the iOS and Android apps right from our website, themeadhouse.com. You can also listen to us right here live at themeadhouse.com. But, hey, if you got to take us mobile, then make sure you get one of the two apps, or, hell, get them both for all I care. We do have a Facebook, just simply The Mead House. You can, I would say, Google that, but you can't Google that, right? You just put The Mead House up in that little search deal on the Facebook thing. It should pop right on up. We don't Twitter. Sorry. And the Mead House. I mean, we do have the website that's kind of home base for us. Then it's just simple, themeadhouse.com. Call in number always 818-921-4680. Hell, put it on your speed dial. We'd love to hear from you during the show, anytime during the show. And guys, tonight I think what we're going to do is make a regular segment here. We'll spend a little bit of time later on the show talking about what's in the hopper, and we'll kind of point to what we each got going, projects, even a to-do list that we'd like to at least get started. But first, I have no idea what anybody's drinking. I know what I'm drinking, so I'm going to start it off. I got me a bottle. Now, understand that mead in my town is kind of hard to come by. Got to reach over here and get this bottle. I'm drinking Redstone Meadery's Mountain Honey Wine Traditional. And this is really good stuff. This is probably one of the first really good traditionals I've had. And I've kind of been looking around because I've got a couple of traditionals working, but I have no idea what to expect out of them. And I needed to taste some kind of a traditional so I can at least get an idea where I should be headed, knowing that, based on the varietals and the yeast and everything, it's all going to taste different, but at least this gives me a pretty good idea. Aaron, What are you drinking tonight?
Well, before I mention that, I'm just a little curious. Is the one that you're having there, is it a little on the sweeter side, drier side? Where does it fall on that spectrum?
Well, it's, I don't know. You know what? I don't go for all these terms and everything because I have no idea what they all mean. I would call it like a medium sweet. It's not real sweet and not real dry. It's somewhere in between.
It's that happy medium.
Exactly. Okay. And, you know, for a guy who doesn't really like a lot of sweet stuff, this is actually pretty good.
Interesting. Well, it sounds really nice. And I'll tell you, traditionals are definitely one of my favorite styles of mead. That's what got me into mead, was actually tasting a really, really good traditional, and just how good and complex of a flavor you can get just with the honey, water, and yeast and nutrients. So after last week's African Iki Laka, whatever the heck that was, I decided to go with something I could pronounce this week, and I'm just having a traditional myself, one that I brewed up probably a year and a half or a couple of years ago, one that fermented pretty bone dry, but I went back and back sweetened it a little bit, and it's probably similar to what you're having there, JD, a little bit on the happy medium, not too sweet, not too dry, semi-sweet level.
It's the kind that keeps you pouring, you know, it's the kind that just keeps your glass full type of thing, you know?
That's right. Yeah, easy drinking, goes down smooth.
Jeff, what do we got going at your house?
Tonight I'm drinking another one of my my little experiments from last year. I want to say it's off dry, kind of off sweet. It's somewhere in between there. And I used a tea substitute called honeybush tea. That's more herbally, but it has a supposedly a pronounced honey flavor, and paired that with a little bit of apricot, actually. And it, I really wish it had been a little bit more apricot forward. I think that would have been a nicer flavor, but all in all, it's not bad.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I could dig an apricot, something with apricot in it. You know, I've heard of people actually taking Chardonnay wines and or even Pinot Grigios and dropping some dried apricots for a little while. Of course, I've been known to drop a little sprig of rosemary in a Chardonnay as well, but... Chris, you're off the meds, right?
I am back to drinking.
There you go. So what do we got? What's in your hopper tonight?
Yes. Well, I've got the last bottle of one of last year's meads that I made. It was a banana fig with sourwood honey. And this is the last bottle. When I finished it out, it was semi-sweet, but as it's got some age on it, a lot of the honey and the fruit character has really started to come back, and that perceived sweetness is kicking in, so it's a little bit more on the sweet side now after a year. And this is the last bottle, so now that I'm tasting it now, I think I may do this again.
Do it again. There you go. One leads to the other. That's the cool thing about doing this too. Is, you know, you make one batch, you know, and the second batch may not even come out as good, or might even be better. It's all based off of you know, the time of year, the honey. I mean, there's a whole discussion there too. But that's the cool thing about making mead, I think.
Yeah. Next, we had said next week we were going to be talking about some. Recipe formulations and helping people with that, and yeah. I think this is a good example here of something that we'll talk about next week, is sort of taking into account how things are going to change when they age, because this one has definitely gone sweet, so you have to think about how things, flavors are going to start coming back, and that perceived sweetness that comes back with the honey after a year or so can really change it a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad you're out of the wheelchair and been, you know, able to stand upright off the meds and can join the rest of the world here with a little bit of libation now and again.
Got to make up for lost time now, Chris.
Yeah, maybe could be that.
I'll probably finish the whole model.
I like it.
I was going to say, it could be the reason why that's the last bottle, too.
I'm probably just changing meds, actually.
All right. So we're on day 21, guys, of the simple mead recipe we put together. Remember that orange blossom tradition we started 21 days ago? Where should we be now? And again, this is a 5-gallon batch. With orange blossom honey, around 20 pounds or so. Actually, I think we just went ahead and used 20 pounds, period. 71 B yeast. And day 21. Chris, where should we be now?
Well, fermentation should be all but complete. You're probably seeing very little, if any, airlock activity. I think you're probably going to be at the end of fermentation by now. You may have reached it several days ago, actually. Any bubbling that you see is probably just off gassing at this point. So it's time to rack off your sediment. And, this thing's been sitting undisturbed now for 2 weeks. So, it should be settled out fairly well. So it's time to go ahead now and rack this thing off the sediment into a 5-gallon glass carboy. You know, Better Bottle makes a plastic carboy, and there's nothing at all wrong with them. I've used them. And as far as how they affect your mead, I can't tell any difference. But I have found that I prefer glass because when you pick it up, you don't have to worry about it affecting your airlock and sucking the liquid back into the carboy. So spend a few extra bucks and get the glass one if you can.
Yeah.
Go ahead and take about a 6-inch vanilla bean, cut it up into like 1-inch pieces or so. Drop it in the carboy and then rack onto it. Leave as much sediment behind as you can. You should have plenty to top the carboy up to the neck and still leave behind the sediment. Put an airlock in it and, leave it for at least a couple of weeks till you hear from us again.
You bet. And they can find the recipe at themeadhouse.com. It's right there on our website. Oh, if you're eager to get started, it's a very simple traditional mead made with orange blossom honey, 71B yeast. Just follow the instructions. Pretty detailed. TheMeadHouse.com. Let's talk about calculating some nitrogen. Sergio Mutella has a page, and for the life of me, I can't remember, and I forgot to bookmark it.
MeadMadeRight.com.
MeadMadeRight.com. There you go. And he's got actually it's not even a theory anymore because it's actually working and working for a lot of people. But let's talk about the nitrogen end of it, which is almost foreign science to me. How do we do that? How do we calculate the nitrogen?
So the nitrogen amount, it depends on a couple of factors. So it's going to depend on your starting gravity level as well as your batch size. So I would definitely refer anybody to the meadmaderight.com webpage for detailed instructions on how to do this. What I was thinking we could do to kind of walk through an example, and I don't know how good a radio this is going to make for, but we were talking about what we have in the hopper, and I recently picked up 10 pounds of a basswood honey from a winter's farmer's market here in Milwaukee, which, by the way, is, other than ice fishing, one of the few things that's enjoyable outside this time of year in Wisconsin. So what I'm thinking about doing with this honey is making a 3-gallon batch and I want to retry my luck with that US05 Cefal ale yeast. So I was thinking we could walk through this as an example of how to use the Tosna method. And so, like I was saying, it's something where it depends on your starting gravity as well as the batch size. So last time I tried my experiments with the ale yeast, I started at 25 bricks. And that's about a starting gravity of about 1.1055 or so. And they just crapped out on me. So for this next batch, I'm thinking I'll do a starting gravity of about 1.0875, which would translate to a starting bricks of 21. And looking at Sergio's website, what that would translate to is 200 milligrams of nitrogen per liter. Now, as you step that up, if you were to go from 21 to 23 bricks, it would be 250. 23 to 25 would be another increase of 50 milligrams nitrogen per liter to 300, so on and so forth. From there, you would take that target milligrams of nitrogen per liter and divide by 50. So 200 milligrams nitrogen per liter divided by 50 equals 4. From there, you just multiply that by your number of gallons and your batch size. And like I said, I'm going to be doing a 3-gallon batch. So 4 times 3 equals 12. Yeah. From there, that's your total grams of Fermade O that you would use. So with the Tosna method, you would split that out into 4 separate dosages of Fermade O. Each one would be, 12 divided by 4, which would be 3 grams per addition.
There you go. That sounds pretty simple.
And that's it. And the reason you're dividing that by 50, let's mention this also. Each of these nutrients provides a different amount of nitrogen. And it turns out that Fermade O provides, as best we can calculate, about 50 parts per million. So that's why we're dividing by 50. Let's also make sure that we give Sergio all the credit for this, because he is the one that came up with this, and he's a really nice guy. I've talked with him quite a bit, and but anyway, yeah, the Fermade O is going to provide about 50 parts per million per gram, and whereas Fermade K would supply about 100 parts per million. So if you were doing this calculation using Fermade K, you would divide by 100 instead of 50.
Divide by 100 instead of 50. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of going along with the flow, because everywhere I see everybody talking to now, it seems a lot of these recipes are switching over to the Fermade O. Been a lot of talk, a lot of discussion. I remember on the old show, we got into several discussions about Fermade O. And of course, Sergio Metella, let's mention his website, melovino.com. Out there in New Jersey, let me tell you, he puts together some pretty darn good meads out there too. So if you get a chance, and I believe he ships through Vino Shipper, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, unfortunately not to Wisconsin, so I may need to have a special delivery for my in-laws there, and they live in Illinois, so that might be a way I can procure some Melovino mead.
Yeah, he puts together some pretty good stuff out there in New Jersey. But and he also put this Tosna thing together. Chris, a lot of people are using this Tosna with great success, because they're basically going from bucket to bottle in a relatively short period of time.
They are, and it seems to be working really well. However, I have a method that uses the Tosna, sort of a variant of it, I guess you would say.
A modified version?
Yeah, modified. And so basically I do the same exact thing. I do the same calculations, except I use Fermade K rather than Fermade O. And Fermade K is primarily an organic source of nitrogen, just like from AO. The only difference, it does have some DAP, and it does have the addition of some vitamins and minerals in it. I don't know if it's possible to get the exact breakdown, because I'm assuming it's a proprietary blend, but I have seen some papers from Lalaman that mentioned that it had some B vitamins in it for sure. So, but it is, it's primarily an organic form as far as I can tell, with just a small amount of DAP in it. And since I do a lot of high gravity stuff, like you were mentioning, I've got a couple that I start at 1162 as a starting gravity. And I think that little bit of DAP that's in there helps get things going. And, so I've actually had better luck with the real high gravity stuff using the Firmate K, but I still use the same calculations and everything. I just divide by 100 instead of 50. And so there's all sorts of ways you can do this.
Have you used the Firmate O at all, or do you just you prefer Firmate K?
No, I have used the Firmate O. I did a traditional batch using only the Firmate O and strictly the TOSNA protocol, and it turned out fine. But it also started at a much lower gravity than what I usually do. So that's just an observation that I have found, that, you know, up to about 1130, somewhere around in there, you know, maybe even 1140, the TOSNA with Firmate O works pretty good. But once you start getting above 1140, I've had better luck with the Firmate K.
Yeah. Well, you've also got some very special taste buds inside your mouth too.
Not really.
Well, you're one of the few people I know that can actually taste the DAP. So when you're using this TOSNA thing, of course DAP is basically nitrogen, right?
Yeah, it's inorganic.
You're not able to taste the finite amounts that come in the Firmate K, then, obviously.
No, I can't detect it. The only time I can detect that is when it's used in what I would consider the more traditional staggered nutrient additions, where you use two parts DAP and one part Firmate K, and I can taste it, and I shouldn't be able to, because that should be assimilated by the yeast, and it shouldn't be there, but for some reason I can taste it. So I guess I'm just an oddball.
Aaron, let's hear from both of you. Aaron, do you have any, can you taste the nitrogen at all, the DAP, like Chris can, or is it?
It's an interesting question. So I'll tell you an experience that I've had, and this was actually a batch of a peach melomel that I made maybe a year or so ago, and this was before I had stumbled across the MeadMadeRight.com website and had really been exposed to Firmate O or Firmate K. This was back in the dark ages where I was still using, I don't even know what it was, whatever packets of yeast nutrients and yeast energizers that my local homebrew supply shop sells. And this was even in the dark ages where I wasn't really tailoring the amount of nutrients to use based on things like batch size or starting gravity. So I suspect that I added more nutrients to this batch than what was needed. And to me, this is going to sound kind of gross, but it kind of like left a little bit of a weird, like a bathroom smell to it, or like almost like a uriny smell. And I know that sounds really disgusting, but
especially like, on radio. Yeah.
Especially on radio, yeah. So
well, Aaron, the DAP is a urea based Now, don't misunderstand what I'm saying here, because there are some purely urea based things that are not even, I don't think they're even allowed to be used on a commercial scale. But if I'm not mistaken, I believe that the DAP is a urea based nitrogen, or at least part of it, I think. Now, I may be wrong about that.
Okay, Doc.
There may be different formulations, but I know that there are some that are based on urea, yeah.
And that's actually what I thought, because the homebrew supply shop does sell just like nutrients that you can buy in like a little jar or something like that, and it says like one of the ingredients is urea. So as I was reading that, I was thinking, well, maybe that's where that taste is coming from, and you know, maybe that's what's causing that. So
wow.
But you know, the actual flavor that you get from the DAP, if you're able to detect it, it's bothersome. But what's even more bothersome to me is the fact that overuse of DAP creates such a vigorous and fast and hot ferment that you're getting these higher and hotter alcohols, and you get a much harder to control ferment. So for people, you know, there for a while, I really had a problem getting a mead to stop where I wanted it to. No matter what I did, the yeast would way overshoot their alcohol limits. And, you know, so I would try to engineer something to finish out sweet or semi-sweet or something, and it'd go bone dry every time. And I finally figured out it was the DAP that's doing it. I mean, it's just like giving them a Snickers bar or something. It's a shot of sugar, basically, that just, they just go and go and go. Whereas the more organic forms like Fermate K and Fermate O, it's a slower, more steady, easier to control ferment, and it's more predictable.
Absolutely. And just the way you're describing that is exactly how so many of my previous batches turned. Is, you know, no matter how much honey I would put in there, it just seemed like they kept on fermenting out bone dry. And I mean, they would just taste like rocket fuel with those hot fusel alcohols that you'd produce with such a fast, vigorous fermentation.
And Jeff, you kind of got that experiment thing going on too there, which,
yes,
you know, kind of fits in with this whole thing, you know, we're talking about here. But first, you know, what's your approach to this TOSNA thing, the Fermate O, Fermate K, nitrogen? Do you fall into the method that Sergio has put out there on a general rule, as a general rule outside your experiments?
Honestly, the experiment is the first and only time I've used TOSNA myself. This round of experimentation is actually the first time I've broken with anything other than following the directions on the package explicitly.
Yeah.
Actually, I take that back. I did stagger some DAP and Fermate K in the last summer and in the fall, but it wasn't nearly as well thought out as it could have been. It was still essentially measuring by volume and just kind of splitting that up.
Well, I think... you know, for me, and I'm kind of working myself out of this old school train of thought, and I'm that way with a lot of things in my life. But you know, going from bucket to bottle in the shortest amount of time, and being able to drink it, I mean, that's kind of the world we live in today, I guess. And I'm starting to be okay with it. You know, and I was a little leery about it at first because I was treating making mead like making wine. You know, a lot of detail, give it everything you got and put it away and let it age until it's great, you know, and then drink it.
And that's a point that should be brought up about all this. Just because we're making or we're able now to make mead that can be enjoyed at 3 months old does not mean it won't get better, because it certainly will. This banana fig here that I have, it was great 2 months after it was pitched. It's even better now at a year old.
Yeah.
So it will continue to get better, and there's nothing wrong with laying a few bottles down. But, you know, even in the wine industry, you've got all the nouveaus and things that people are looking to. The whole staggered nutrient addition came about from the wine industry looking for ways to make their wine drinkable faster.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, like I said, I'm starting to fall in line, I guess, a little bit with it. And the other thing too is aging is kind of a saving grace type of thing, because my very first big batch that I think I explained on the show here a couple of weeks ago, I was actually drinking on one of the shows. You know, it was before I really knew anything, and I just. You know, had read things on the internet, and I put this batch together. Well, it came out, and I swear I could have sold it to the government for rocket fuel. But I kept reading that, you know, just leave it alone. Just, you know, put it in a clean carboy, put an aerolite, just put it away, and let it roll. You know, for at least a year. So I did that, and lo and behold, you know, I mean, it's not the best mead in town, but you know that rocket fuel taste has significantly subsided, and it's starting to taste more like a wine, you know. So there is an advantage to letting them sit for, you know, too, if you're having some difficulty with, of course, my difficulty was with heat, but age does enhance things.
And it always will. No matter how good it is coming out of the carboy, it's going to get better with age. And I don't think anyone would deny that. But, you know, I've got here, this banana fig, had I made it the way I used to make it, I wouldn't be drinking it right now, let alone being on the last bottle. So, you know, I like to, I guess I'm one of the instant gratification people too, although in the meat world, you know, 3 months is instant gratification, so.
Yeah.
That was one of the hardest things for me to adjust to, coming from the world of making beer, which I thought required such a great deal of patience. You know, you put the batch together and it's a month before you're drinking it. Well, that's just such a short time scale compared to that of mead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, if anybody's interested, you simply go to meadmaderight.com. Sergio Mutella from Elevino Meadery. You know, he's got it all set up right there. Just read the directions, follow through. We'll repost them, I'm sure, with Sergio's blessing, on our website at themeadhouse.com. And, you know, use it. You know, I mean, if you're looking to drink your mead in a respectable amount of time, or at least in a shorter amount of time, then, you know, perhaps you should try this, because this is what I'm hearing from people who are using this method. You know, that they're able to, you know, like I say, go from bucket to bottle in, say, 90 days, 3 to 4 months, you know.
Hands down. I mean, with that honey varietal experiment thing I've got going on, I'll tell you, 30 days, 1 month in primary fermentation, that mead came out smoother and just cleaner and just more palatable than some of my other meads have turned out, even after 12 months of aging. So right. Definitely appreciative to the meadmaderight.com website and all of the information that Sergio's put out there.
Yeah.
Yep. And Jeff's got some interesting interesting information from his experiments going on. I don't think you're ready to divulge everything about that quite yet, are you?
Well, we talked a little bit, was it last week or the week before? And yeah, there are some marked flavor differences. I have not sampled again. I've been resisting the urge to you know, mother hen this thing. But we sampled that when we racked in the secondary, and you know, lo and behold, out of the very subjective flavor sampling that my wife and I did, I found the Tosna was actually the second most palatable out of five. The only one that was a little bit more palatable to me at the time was the one that actually started with the DAP and fermented K, and then switched to Tosna in for the second two editions. Switched to fermented O for the second two editions.
So there's all sorts of combinations you can do with this, with all three nutrients, actually, starting with one and ending with the other, or back and forth. And so I guess the jury is still out on what's going to end up being the best. And in my experience, like I was saying with the starting gravity, there may not be a one size fits all. It may be something you have to take with, you know, batch to batch.
Absolutely. And this is just like you'll get different results from different yeasts. I'm guessing you'll probably get different results with different nutrient additions with different yeasts. But on the subject of the calculations and stuff, there's also another website. I plugged this during the first episode. It's the Batch Builder from Mead. It's the Mead Maker podcast. Very easy to use. You use little sliders to select like the size of your batch, your intended final gravity, and then they give you three different options for nutrient additions there. So they do the complicated math stuff for you. That might be useful to people to check out.
That's what I need. I need to hire somebody to do the math calculations for me. I'm too damn old for all this stuff. All right. So if you're not doing it, try it. And let us know what you think about it, you know, if you do use the Tosna. Right now, I think Brett has joined us. Brett Tennant, is that you, I suppose?
Yep, that is me.
There you go. Now, here's the deal. I was cruising through the Mead groups and saw an interesting post about this chocolate mead that Brett was working on. And Brett, I got to be honest, I'm not a real fan of pretty much chocolate anything. And
you know, I'm right there with you. I've got a couple friends who love chocolate, basically, and one of the guys like, "Oh, you should do a chocolate mead. That'll go crazy." So,
yeah,
I had extra stuff. I'd bought a 50-pound batch of honey and was at the farmer's market and found some cocoa powder and had seen the liquid sex mead recipe and thought I'd give it a whirl.
Now, is this your first? You've been making mead for a while, right?
No, not at all, actually. I started at the end of January with my first batch.
Okay.
I'm one of those people that researches the hell out of everything and then tries to make a go of it.
Yeah.
So my first mead was put in end of January, and I ran a dragon fruit blood orange / maple syrup mix. And a couple weekends ago, I had bottled it, and we had a friend's party, so they convinced me to bring one along, and it was gone in seconds.
Big hit, huh?
So only 2 months in, it was
crystal clear.
Yeah, so I thought, well, you know, if it was that big of a hit, we'll give it a whirl with some of the other ones. We've tried the...
How did the chocolate thing start? How did you come around to getting interested in making...
The chocolate was literally, we had been reading about dessert meads and dessert bottles and stuff like that. And one of my buddies is kind of helping me out, like, financially with funding this. Like, we started out as just going to be a thing for, like, trading. We have friends that do, like, leather work and stuff like that. So I was like, I'm looking for a hobby that I can swap goods with.
Yeah.
And immediately I had people messaging me about buying bottles and stuff. because it's relatively hard to find around here. For those that don't know, I'm Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
Oh wow, cool.
Yeah, so we have
we meadery can because I'm a mead maker and I do leather work. So yeah, it's kind of weird. And I'm fixing to do a chocolate too. So
yeah, and I got
a long lost brother or something.
It could be. I got laid off a couple of weeks ago. So it's just kind of one of those things where you're looking to fill your daytime. So I kind of amped up my production, yeah. And that's why the chocolate one came in. We're trying to come up with different ideas.
Yeah.
We have there's a local meadery called Fallen Timbers up here. Yeah. They produce really good stuff, but I tend to find their stuff rather dry. And I think that has a lot to do with the liquor laws up here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I know a little bit about the Canadian liquor, you know, especially with the mead making, where depending upon the type of license you get, apparently you have to actually raise your own honey. You have to have beehives.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the chocolate thing. Now I've read that using chocolate, you have to let them age at least a year or even longer.
Exactly, and that's and you guys talking a few minutes ago about how the waiting, getting used to the waiting for a year and stuff. Like I had immediate results with the first batch, but knowing this one's going to have to sit for a year, it's going to be a close watch basically, and anticipation until it finally happens.
And to your knowledge, there's no way around that. I mean, when we're talking specifically about the oils in the...
Exactly, yeah. And I had done a bunch of reading on, I think it's the Mead Maker Forum, and I had read a bunch of batches a while ago, because apparently there was a bunch of people doing some chocolate back then. And the most common recipe is basically once you do your second racking, your first racking over, you have to let that rack sit for a year.
Wow.
And there's people that apparently will, they'll keep racking like monthly, trying to let the oils that are on the top, like eliminate them. Yeah. But apparently what that does is that also eliminates the enzyme that everybody likes.
That gives it the mm-hmm. flavor, right?
Exactly, yeah. So
experiment.
Go ahead, Chris.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that's one of the big experiments is seeing how this one works out.
Yeah. Cool. And one of the big experiments for me, I've got a couple that are going to be going in the primary within the next few weeks. And I'm going to be doing a comparison between using cocoa nibs and Dutch cocoa powder. And from the research that I've done, the Dutch powder removes a lot of the offensive bitterness and leaves more of the pure chocolate flavor. So I'm interested to see how that's going to come out. And then I've heard mixed things about using cocoa nibs. Do you use them raw? Do you toast them first?
Right.
So there's quite a bit of experimentation that can go on here with this chocolate. So
well, and the downside is that 90% of the stuff that I found out there of people doing recipes, I've never seen a lot of responses to what happened, like what ended up happening. Was their batch spoiled? Did it work out? Did it taste like crap? Like, I've never seen a lot of that. So, and yet a lot of the posts are from back around, say, 2011, 2012. So there's got to be some knowledge out there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it might be an embarrassment thing. You know, I did this batch of meat. It turned out like crap and,
yeah,
but nobody wants to say that publicly, you know.
Yeah, and that's I did the same thing with the raspberry vanilla I'm working on. Like I thought it stalled or I killed it somehow or something when all the yeast went to the bottom. So luckily the Facebook group and the other places are there, and they're like, oh no, don't worry about it, just give it a couple of days. Yeah. But like that's the inexperience and my, you know, experimentation kind of just flowing through.
Yeah,
but the chocolate one's bubbling like every 3 seconds right now, so it's going pretty good.
How big a batch is this?
It's just a 1 gallon batch right now. That's what I started out with. Is I bought 4 or 5 1 gallon carboys, yeah. And then I wasn't even going to go big until basically all the popularity and a bunch of friends are wanting to buy bottles off me and stuff. So
funny how that works out, huh?
Yeah. So basically the funny thing is, like, I sold a bunch of the bottles from those 1 gallon batches and paid back covered all my output, and then was able to cover the cost of buying another set batch of 50 pounds of honey, which was $300.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. And what kind of honey did you use this?
That one's a wild. That's going to be it's a wildflower mixture that the beekeeper out here sells. It's one of his higher end honeys. So his clover honey is pretty good, and that's what I used in one of the first batches. But it's a little pricier to go the small bottle routes, whereas he sells the big batch for $300. But then, of course, you know, a couple of days later, I find a posting in one of the wine shops here in town where someone's selling honey to mead makers for $3 a batch or a pound.
There you go. That's a good
thing. Yeah, so it's just research, and we got to find out sources.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's how you do it, you know. I'll be talking about some resources that I found on my little excursion here over the weekend here in a little bit, if you want to stay tuned. But, Chris, we're going to go through the hopper list here in just a bit, but you got an inkling to do it. You said a chocolate strawberry and what else?
So right now I've got, are you talking to me or?
Chris.
Okay, sorry. For me?
Yeah, Chris.
Okay, well, this is two batches I've got planned to do. I've got a chocolate orange and a chocolate strawberry that I'm going to do. And that's where I'm going to test the difference between the nibs and the Dutch powder. And I've got a feeling that the Dutch cocoa powder is going to win out. And because a lot of the bitterness has been removed from it, I'm going to use it along with the strawberries because they're a lighter flavor. And then I'm going to use the cocoa nibs along with the orange. And we'll see how that goes.
I got this coffee thing going on here at my place. I'm thinking along the lines of, what do they call that at Starbucks anyway, guys?
Like a mocha?
Mochaccino.
Ooh, I like the sounds of that.
Huh?
Yeah. I like the sounds of that, yeah.
Good stuff. Yeah. Brett, hey, you're welcome to stick around with us if you'd like. We're on for
about... I'll probably just listen in due to the long distance costs. But
you're up there in Canada. Gosh.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I appreciate you calling in and sharing.
A problem, guys.
This is what this show is all about. We're just a bunch of guys.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I'll be listening again.
Yeah, I hope so. Join us anytime.
You bet. We'll talk to you guys later.
Thank you, Brett.
Have a good show.
You bet. Wow. Gosh, the wheels are already turning, guys. I can see this chocolate mocha thing going. You know,
we need to get Eric Newquist from Acer Meadery back on because in addition to his coffee mead, he's also doing some with chocolate. So he would be another good resource to talk about this. As a matter of fact, I was thinking about shooting him an email before I put these two batches together and just sort of run my ideas by him and see what he thinks about it.
Yeah. In that email, why don't you ask him if he would be willing to come back on the show and talk to us again? We'll get him on.
Yeah. The last time I emailed him after he was on, I told him that we would probably like to have him back on sometime, and he said he would come back on any time. We just give him some notice. So,
good deal.
Yeah. Well, he's got a lot of interesting flavor combinations going, so using, you know, all these different ingredients that we don't normally use. So, Sergio's, he does that as well, you know, what was that one he made, cucumber and...
Cucumber.
cucumber and lemon or something.
It was just a straight cucumber mead, and then I had the I think it was called
Patino.
The jalapeno peppers.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
But
I like the idea of using all these different ingredients that are not normally thought of.
Well, yeah, you know. You know, like we keep saying, I mean, that's kind of the fun thing about working with mead. You know, I mean, the sky's the limit. I mean, you know, pick out an. I would have never have thought bananas. I just cannot see a banana wine. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, this banana fig is really good, and it's not a strong. It's not a strong banana. The banana sort of goes more toward the white wine aspect of it.
Yeah.
But there is a banana flavor there, and it goes well with the fig. So.
Well, what's in the hopper, guys? This is going to be a regular segment here on the Mead House. Let's start off with Aaron. What do you got in the hopper, Aaron?
Good question. So earlier when we were talking a little bit about the Tosna and all of that, I alluded to this 10 pounds of basswood honey that I picked up here at this farmer's market here in town. And I'm thinking of doing kind of a lower gravity session mead with the ale yeast. And when I first started putting the plans together for this, I was thinking of doing a traditional. But then I've actually, in addition to the 4 gallons of the honey varietals that I've got going on, I've also got another 3 gallons of a wildflower traditional going on. So I'm thinking I might want to jazz this up a little bit. And to do so, I'm debating between adding like hops to it, or maybe doing like a melomel and adding something like a blueberry or a blackberry or something like that. This honey is really, really clean tasting and pretty bright and tart. So in terms of like the type of fruit that I might want to add, one of my favorite fruits to add would be something like a raspberry, but some of the raspberries you get up here are just pretty, you know, sour and tart, and I'm thinking I'm looking for something a little bit, you know, rounder and a little sweeter. So
red or black raspberry?
Red ones.
Yeah, those red are a little ones. On the tart side, I think. A little tart, a little more tart than black raspberry.
Absolutely. So, you know, something like a blueberry that maybe is not quite as tart as that, and maybe just a little more softer of a flavor, that might complement better with the tartness from this basswood honey.
Yeah. Basswood honey.
You said it's a pretty clean flavor, because I've heard there can be a little bit of a not necessarily citrusy, but kind of an acidy bite with the basswood honey. Are you finding that? Or is this just the tart?
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. Maybe the tartness is what I'm picking up, but another way to describe it definitely could be kind of an acidic bite. Absolutely.
Yeah, I had basswood honey one time, and it was quite acidic. It was, and I always describe it, when you put a little bit in your mouth and you swallow it, and you feel that little bit of burn in the back of your throat,
mm-hmm.
The basswood honey had a lot of that burn.
Yeah.
And that's how I usually judge the acidity of a honey.
Well, yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say I'm definitely picking up some of that. And, you know, I was hoping that, and we'll see how this turns out, but hopefully with that ale yeast, you know, also being kind of a cleaner ferment and things like that, I'm just hoping to what I'm shooting for is something that would be just a nice, easy drinking, summery, you know, maybe I might even make it sparkling type of a just an easy sit on the back porch, you know, put on some music and listen to some music and drink some of that mead. So that's kind of what I'm shooting for with this batch.
Yeah, that sounds good. Jeff, what do you got in the hopper, bud?
Well,
you know what? Before you start that, I should have put this in the show notes and I didn't. And I was on vacation and just happened to be checking things on the Facebook thing. And I stumbled across this post real quick. You are now officially a judge.
Yes, I got my tasting score back over the weekend from the BJCP, the Beer Judging Certification. I'm a terrible member. I don't remember what the B stands for, but it's the organization that certifies judges for competitions like the Mazer Cup or the various regional competitions we talked about last week. So very pleased to say I'm officially a mead judge.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So, guys, we're pretty fortunate now that we've got an official judge on our little panel here, don't you think?
Well, I can't let him have any of my mead now because then everybody's going to find out that I don't make good mead.
Go ahead.
In addition to being one of the top three mead makers in the world...
Yeah, what can I say? My star's on the rise here, guys.
We're going to have to kick him off the show. He's going to have to get his own show.
Well, when his head gets swelled up to the size, he can't fit into the... Well, there really isn't any doorway here, is there?
No.
I think he's going to be all right. But again, congratulations, Jeff. We're glad to hear that. Now, what's in the hopper?
So the only thing I've actually got bubbling away right now is that experiment we were talking about before with all the different nutrient additions, but there's a lot on my plate that's being planned out, but I've been gun shy getting. Okay, the wish list is pretty extensive, but here it goes. Kind of corollary to what Aaron was talking about, I picked up just a few pounds of honey from a different local beekeeper while I was at the farmer's market a couple of weeks ago, and I've been thinking about something I can do to kind of see how I like his compared to some of the other honeys I've been using, and decided I want to go back to a tried and true recipe from last year that I really liked, which was my hopped mead. And so I'm thinking about variations for that. The one that we made before was like a 14% alcohol, and I think I want to step that back to more of a session-y kind of like Aaron was saying, just sip and enjoy on a really hot summer day kind of a thing. The one I used before had it actually just had some leftover Saaz hops from a Czech Pilsner beer kit that I'd bought, and I really liked that. And so now I'm experimenting a little bit with different additions. There is a different crop of Saaz hops this year that has a lot more of the alpha acid, the bitterness of the hops, I'm told. So, I'm going to try, I think, a gallon of that. And then I got a blend of hops from the West Coast called Falconer's Flight, which is, a kind of a proprietary blend, but it incorporates a bunch of different hop varieties into a pellet form. And I've tasted a little bit of IPA made with it, so it came out really nicely. I'm kind of curious to see where that's going.
Jeff, if you don't mind me asking, what quantity of hops do you use per gallon?
That's a good question, and I'm actually playing with that. The batch I did last year, I used about a half an ounce per gallon, and I think this year I'm going to half an ounce. And I actually I boiled about a quart of water, and let the hop pellets boil out in that for about 10 minutes before I added that to the honey. Well, I turn it off, let it cool. I added that to the honey and then added cold spring water to balance out the gallon.
Okay. So you added it to your primary then?
Right. Yeah. I let it ride the whole way through. And actually I found that the, kind of like the chamomile, the hops helps clarify a lot faster than a normal mead does. So you get a little bit of bonus there if you're looking for a nice, bright, shiny mead.
Okay. You're talking me into, doing a hopped mead here with this basswood.
Well, and I tell you, I really liked the way the hop came out because it was actually, it came out dry, but the sweetness of the kind of a florally, noble hop from the saws, it deceptively made you think it was a little bit sweeter than it really was when it came out bone dry.
Hmm.
So.
Sounds tasty.
Do you get, is it like a beer type flavor? I mean, is that the ultimate result that you get out of these popped up meads?
Actually, no. There is a level of, you can taste the hops in it, but you miss the barley, and the other more like beer aspects of it. So it becomes something that's not quite a normal mead and not quite a beer. But I found it was a very pleasant medium there.
Wow. Now, Jeff, do you carbonate that at all, or do you just serve it still?
The stuff I made, I serve still because I got the alcohol tolerance and I couldn't bottle condition it at all.
Gotcha.
I lack a CO2 regulator or tank or anything like that to force carbonate it. So that's just kind of how it went. I'm thinking if I do like a 6 or 7% session mead this time around, I might try bottle carbonation. So I think that could be awful pleasant.
Okay. Wow.
That's one of the topics we're going to get into, probably after we come back from our hiatus. I had a listener write in and ask us to do a segment about carbonation. Apparently that's a big thing in mead making as well. So we'll eventually get around to that. But, I have a very long list, and I need to add one of these hopped up meads to it because it sounds like an interesting flavor that I would enjoy. I mean, I like a good beer. I enjoy tasting the hops and the barleys and everything about a craft beer, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I will say, last year I did a lot of experimenting with herbs and things like that, and this year I think I'm really more drawn towards doing some melomels and playing with fruits and stuff, but the different varieties of hops give you so many different options that there is part of me that's always going to be kind of like wondering about different combinations and different types of hops working into a mead and seeing where that takes me. So yeah, it's a really tantalizing little angle there.
I know for me, my hopper, right now my hopper is filled with a coffee mead experiment that Chris and I have been kind of talking offline about for the last few days or week and a half or whatever. And it started out with about 2.5 pounds of cold brewed coffee in about a gallon of water. When I finally added the honey to it, which, and I don't measure honey by pounds anymore. I go strictly by the hydrometer. I just keep mixing until I get to the point where I want. I found that's much more. I'll guess at somewhere around 4 pounds, maybe, if I had to guess. But we started out at, 1 point, what was it, Chris? What did I say?
I think you started at 11:30,
and with 71 B, it crapped out at 10:50. I'm not sure why. Temperatures are good. I mean, the whole aeration, stirring, nutrient feeding. I did the 24/72 thing with Permade O. That I think it was like 3.24 grams per. But it's, Chris and I were talking, before the show or earlier this afternoon, it should have come out sweet, even at 10:50, you know, but the sweetness isn't there. And I think I know why. And this is something that I think Eric was alluding to when he was talking about, you know, when he was experimenting with his coffee meads, was the fact that there is a bitter component to these to coffee. And I think that may be kind of offsetting the sweetness that I'm not tasting in this coffee experiment that I've got going. Now, I use dark roast coffee. I like a dark roast. And frankly, I was counting on some of that bitterness because I think that's what gives good coffee good flavor, is some of that bitterness, just like a good beer. So, we're at the point now where, you know, we're going to rack it. I'm going to rack it later on tonight after the show. I think I can get I can squeeze a gallon and a half out of it. And I'm just going to let it sit, you know. Go to North Carolina here in about a week and a half. And I get it racked over and just put it on the shelf and airlock it. And just, you know, let it sit. Let it ride. See what happens. Mm-hmm. But, you know, other things that I've got in my hopper, Chris was kind enough to send me, well, it's kind of a swap. I sent him some orange blossom from California, and he sent me some sourwood from Mississippi. And so I'm eager to start, it'll be a small batch, 3-gallon batch of just going to be a straight traditional with sourwood honey that Chris sent me. And so I'm looking forward to doing that when we get back. But I do want to get into doing some of these fruit things. My wife loves strawberries, and I'd like to put a strawberry. And I've been very cautious because I've done a couple, not real happy. Now, Aaron and Jeff, I don't know. You know, when you do your melomels, or even Chris can comment on this too. I don't want this thing to come out tasting like a Kool-Aid, like some of the previous ones that I did. You know what I mean? Like a Kool-Aid with vodka is what it reminded me of.
Yeah.
How do you, you know, and I've been told by, you know, some of the best people in the business, you know, more fruit is better. Okay, this thing about, I think it was 2 pounds per gallon is hogwash. You need to go a lot more than that. 3.5-4 pounds a gallon is what I've heard. You know, but how do you stay away from that Kool-Aid, you know, taste?
Load it up. You're exactly right. Load it up with fruit. 4 to 5 pounds per gallon for something like strawberries is right about in line. 5, even 6 pounds of peaches, loaded up. Otherwise, you come out with, like you're saying, it's got a wine cooler. If you remember the wine coolers from the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I remember Boone's Farm, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I don't want any Boone's Farm together.
Yeah, the my answer has always been loaded up with fruit. If you're going to make, it depends on what you're making. If you're making a session mead that's going to be lighter and carbonated, then maybe you don't want to load it up. But if you're making a traditional still melomel and you're going to make a strawberry, then make a strawberry.
Yeah.
Load it up. Put in about 5 pounds of strawberries per gallon and make it. You know, don't hold back.
Well, funny you should say, because on my trip, I might as well do it now. On my trip, I did a little bit of honey shopping. Now, we went up to, it really wasn't Northern California. It was north for us since we live in Southern California, but up around the Sonora Oakdale area. And we took the long route home, hence my tiredness today after being behind the wheel for 12 hours. But I had to stop in a few little fruit stands on the way, and I ran across some blackberry honey. And I thought, oh, wow. this might be pretty good with a blackberry mead. So with the blackberry honey, they had star thistle. Now, I remember Chris talking about star thistle. And I don't know if that was on the show or off the show. Chris, weren't you talking about star thistle honey at one point?
Well, I've had two experiences with star thistle. One was a traditional that I made. It's a light, just, it's a great honey. It really is. And it turned out, to me, it was lacking. I think it would have been better had it been blended, with something else. The other experience I had with it was, Texas Dave. He had made a star thistle traditional, and that was one of the bottles he sent me, and it was a great traditional. He had a little bit of heat in it. I think maybe his fermentation temperature might have been a little bit high on that one particular batch, but there's no doubt about it. In a year, it would be, all that would be aged out. But his didn't seem to be lacking like the one I made. So, maybe it was a slightly different, you know, difference in the honey or something.
Well, this star thistle honey that I tasted was like a honey on barbiturates. I mean, this stuff was bad. I mean, it was, you know, and I somewhere, I don't know where the conversation, who I had it with, but we were talking star thistle, and they said, well, there's a couple of different kinds of star thistle. Stay away from the weed patch type. And I got a funny feeling this is what that was, because this is really bad. So I put that on the back burner. I didn't want any of that. But the blackberry, of course, they had orange blossom there, too. I can get orange blossom, you know, anywhere down here. But blackberry, you know, is hard to come by. So, but the guy wanted... He wanted like $40. Well, it's actually what I paid was $40 for 6 pounds. And I tried to talk him into. I told him I'd give him $180 for 60 pounds of black. So he wasn't having it. He said it's $300. And I told him, well, you might as well hang on to it because I'm sure your bees are going to need something to munch on. And the reason why I say that, because the honey, I mean, he's got this honey at this little fruit stand, and most of the honey sitting there, you can tell it's old. It's starting to crystallize around the top of the container. There's dust on top of the lid. I mean, it's obvious that stuff has been sitting there for a long, long time. Even talking to the fruit stand. You know, said,
hey. Yeah, at $40, it would have still been sitting there had it been me.
Yeah, so, but I thought, you know, the hell with it. I brought the 6 pounds back, so we're going to do a small batch of blackberry. And my only other problem is I've got to get a source for ripe blackberries. I can get blackberries in the supermarket, no big deal. Like everything else in Southern California, everything is picked long before it's ever ripe. By the time you leave it out and, you know, ripen on the it just doesn't develop like it's still on the tree. So.
JD, I'm getting some interference from somewhere, and I don't know what it is.
That might be.
Are you picking it?
It might be coming from Jeff.
Could be.
Yeah, it is. It's coming from Jeff. I can.
Oh, you still got the little one acting up, don't you?
Yeah, he's getting sent to.
good times. I could. It was sounding like interference over the line or something.
Yeah. So anyway, so we're gonna work. And you know, the blackberry's going on the list. You know, on my hopper list, but. Right now, I've got a couple of traditionals aging. I've got the vanilla aging, the traditional that we put together about, it's going on about 7 months ago now. Still needs a little bit more time. And that's made with the orange blossom honey and D47 yeast. The other one that I've got aging right now is a mesquite and wildflower blend that I put together. The honey, it tasted really good. So I'm hoping that that's going to come out. So,
is JD, is that with that Trader Joe's mesquite?
Yep. Yeah, Trader Joe's mesquite honey. It's pretty good stuff if you can get your hands on it.
Yeah, we've got a Trader Joe's nearby here too, and every time we go, I always look at that mesquite honey and think about picking some up. So add it to my hopper list too.
Yeah, it's gonna have it's gonna have kind of a peppery taste to it when it ferments out, You know, I kind of enjoy that. It tastes pretty good. Obviously, mine's still way, way early yet. I mean, it hasn't even cleared yet. So it's kind of taking its sweet time, in that process. But it's got a peppery taste to it. It's going to be kind of a semi-sweet, when it finishes out. But so looking
forward. And another note you can make with a mesquite. It blends well with orange blossom.
Yeah.
And one of the good traditionals I did was three honeys. It was orange blossom and mesquite. And the third honey, it skips my mind right now. I think it was either sage or the star thistle. No, it wasn't the star thistle. It was, I think it was sage blossom maybe.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it turned out good.
But and then I do have I got a hold of if you've got an IKEA around, I got this wild hair, and I got a couple of containers, little quart jars, not even quart jars, they're probably maybe a pint and a half of lingonberry concentrate. And so I got two of those, mixed it. It already has sugar in it, so I mixed it with some honey, brought it up to a fairly decent starting gravity, used RC212 yeast in it, and right now it's cleared out. It tastes like a lingonberry wine. So kind of a little, an experiment, I guess, if you want to call it that. And then, of course, the it's not mead, but it is a project. I've got a 5-gallon Blackberry Pinot Noir that is in the clearing stages right now. So, and then a 1-gallon hard cider that I threw together about 4 weeks ago. So that's what's in my hopper. Chris, besides the chocolate meads we talked about, I know you got orange and a strawberry. I'd be interested in hearing more about those when you get to them. But what else you got in the hopper, bud?
Well, at the moment, I've got my heart murmur. I've got the final, once the recipe was nailed down, I did the big batch. So I've got that in secondary right now. I've got, of course, my Thai One-On, which is the Thai curry mead. That's in secondary, sitting on the coconut right now. I've got two others, aside from a few test batches that I'm going to be doing, I've got two others that I make. I guess you would consider them regulars for me. One is my sourwood traditional. I normally use 71B. Everyone knows I'm a big 71B yeast fan. As I make more mead, so I've always felt that if you limit yourself, you may be missing out on something. I decided this time on the sourwood traditional, I would see if I could optimize the flavors and what I could come out with. So I contacted Pete Bakalich, and I was talking to him about yeast selection and this particular honey. And so what I came up with is to do a blend. So I'm actually going to make two batches. I'm going to make a fairly large batch using D21 yeast, and then I'm going to do a smaller batch with the RP15. That's the Rock Pile 15 yeast. It's a Loudon. I think it's a Loudon yeast. And then when those...
If you talk to me about it, it's going to be a Loudon yeast.
Yeah.
Pretty much all he used.
Well, you know, there's a reason for that. Their quality is there. So far I haven't got a bad Loudon yeast. Yeah. But it's RP15, and I'm going to use that in a smaller quantity, do two separate batches, and then once I get them finished, I'm going to blend them to taste. So hopefully I'll optimize this sourwood honey to something better than what it's been being. Yeah. The other one I'm going to do is a braggot. That it's the only braggot that I do regularly, and it's one done with I call it an Irish red ale braggot, and it's made with Chinook hops through the boil, and then at the end it's got some East Kent Goldings hops added for the last 5 minutes, and that'll be with some sort of darker, earthier honey, possibly blackberry. Don't know yet exactly what honey I'm going to use this time. The last time I used raspberry honey, and it turned out pretty good. So I'm thinking about trying some blackberry honey on this one, and it's got some dark dry malt extract in it as well. So we'll see how that goes. Yeah. The other thing that I've got on the to-do list, I guess, is a cherry chipotle.
There you go.
Mm. Yeah. So, I normally make a cherry mead. My friends, they all like cherry mead, so I tend to keep a cherry mead going or finished it almost all the time. And so I had some dessert not too long ago that was like a cherry, I don't know what it was called. It was like a cherry cobbler or something. Oh. And along with that meal, I had some chipotle sauce on some food and happened to get them mixed. And I said, that goes pretty good together. So.
Cool. Sounds good. Now, were you ever a beer brewer before?
No, never. I've never made a batch of beer. This is the I've made a couple of braggots, but the other one didn't turn out all that well. This one seems to be really good. I did not come up with this recipe. I got this recipe from someone online, and I don't remember where. If I knew, I would give him credit for it, but I can't remember where I got it. But I made it, and it turned out good, and everyone liked it. So I'm going to keep on making it.
Yeah.
But it's basically some sort of dark honey, dry malt extract, and Chinook and East Kent Golding hops. And I have in my notes that the Chinooks can be interchanged for Eroica, and the East Kent Goldings can be interchanged with Cascade or Centennial. And, gosh, I wish I could remember whose recipe this is so I could give them credit, but it's a good one.
Yeah. Sounds interesting. Well, I want to keep talking about what's in the hopper and what we got going, and maybe we can get into even some more detail, pick out a couple of recipes that we got working or that we really want to put together, and let's go into a little bit more detail about them, in the next few shows. I think, you know, I really want to explore this coffee thing a little bit further. And, you know, before I even get into the whole chocolate coffee thing, I think I feel the need to get the chocolate down. I mean, the coffee mead down first. I would think that that would be the first step. What do you guys think?
You know, as you're describing it right now, I'm wondering if a good possibility might be to make two separate batches, one chocolate, one coffee, and then blend them.
Yeah.
I would second that one. I think, actually, when we talk about recipe formulation and stuff next time, I was going to bring up Steve Piazza's book has a fantastic section about blending, where he uses the term is a Punnett square, but they it's an idea for determining like how much of one ingredient versus another, or how much of one meat or another you want to add to make a good blend. So that could definitely be a useful resource in this case too.
Yeah. Of course, the only drawback is, I mean, you're at least a year out with the chocolate mead, you know, based on everything that I'm reading. But, hey, you know what? What the heck? you never
I'm
know.
Hoping I'm hoping to solve some of that with this Dutch cocoa powder. I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say, Chris, you know, Chris is one, he'll get it from the bottle or from the bucket to the bottle in a big time hurry. Yeah, I might task you with coming up with the plan. But I still want to play around with this coffee thing. I love a good coffee. I mean, as much as a tequila aficionado, I guess. I'm pretty much the same with my coffee, and I'm very, very particular about my coffee. And, I mean, if a cup of coffee in a restaurant doesn't taste good to me, I'll send it back. I'm that bad. Of course, it's, you know, an embarrassment for the wife, but
we've got a coffee snob on our hands.
Hey, you know what? I like coffee. And I like damn good coffee is what I like.
Coffee well, you got
I'm proud of it.
You got two of them because I'm the same way. I guess it's a toss up between a good glass of iced tea and a good cup of coffee. Those are two things that I practically live on. So,
well, the coffee thing, you know, like I said before, I think Eric really hit on something because. You know, what I'm finding out is there is a bitterness that goes along with it. Now, I'm not saying that bitterness is a bad thing because I absolutely believe that a good cup of coffee requires a bit of bitter. And for that reason, I don't like the cold brewed coffees. There's just not enough bitterness in that cup of coffee for me to really enjoy it. And I wanted that component in my mead. I wanted a level of bitterness. Now, you know, it's just a matter of controlling the amount of bitterness. And I think I'm going to be able to do that through the amount of actual bean that you cold brew first.
Or bittering hops and make a coffee braggot.
Well, yeah,
leave it to me to complicate things, but,
you know,
I don't know that I could see a bittering hop and a bitter coffee in the same quantitative or qualitative level of bitterness or like coordinating flavors, but I'd be willing to hear somebody out if they wanted to brew that up and send me some.
Well, that's where you get into the layering effect, you know, like the deal with the curry mead. It's it may not be the most enjoyable, but when you taste it, you take a sip and you taste one thing, and then you take another sip and it's totally different.
Well, that's
interesting to me how that can happen.
Sure, absolutely. And I think the other thing about the coffee mead that Eric was talking about was the actual bean itself. And he's experimented with all sorts, dark roast, light roast, and he's settled on that medium roast, which, you know, there might be something to that too. Maybe that's the direction I need to go. I don't know. I'm going to play around with the dark roast first and just, you know, lower the amount of bean that I use. But, you know, I mean, it's just a wonderful thing about what we're doing is being able to experiment and, you know, come up with a profile that we enjoy and making it work, you know. I mean, what the heck? I mean, I you know, when it comes to the coffee bean, I'm strictly, and I mean strictly, it's either Sumatra or Arabica. A close second to both of those beans is the Ethiopian. Other than that, an Italian roast is okay if I can find a good roast. But Arabica and Sumatra are my two absolute go-to coffee beans, and that's what I've been using. So.
Yeah, a dark Italian roast Arabica is by far my favorite coffee in the world. But the problem is I like it toned down with cream. So, you know, trying to get that quality, when I think about a mead, I know it's going to be absent the cream. So then I start thinking, okay, how do I need to change the roast of the coffee and the strength of the coffee so that I'm going to like it when there's no cream there?
Yeah.
And that's my dilemma. So,
well,
we'll see.
You know, that I have read where there have been instances where people have actually used milk as part of the brewing process. So, but we will absolutely tackle that on a later show. We pretty much run out of time, guys. We're trying to stick to our commitment to keeping these meetings to at least 90 minutes. And as much as I would like to sit around and talk more about mead making, what do you guys think?
I think we got plenty for the next show.
There you go.
Put a bow on this one.
Yep. If we talk about it all now, we won't have nothing to talk about on the next show, right?
Yeah, leave them wanting more.
Well, and Chris, I'm glad you're standing upright again, my friend. That
is great to hear. Absolutely.
Yep. Very glad to hear.
I appreciate it.
You bet.
You can't keep a dangerous redneck down, so you knew it was coming.
Oh, my God.
It was just a matter of time.
We'll talk about it offline. We might even bring it up on the next show, but you got to see the automatic locking chicken coop door that his wife built. We'll talk about that on the next show. We're going to close it out. We'll see you next Tuesday night right here on the Mead House, 9 o'clock p.m. Join us as we get into talking about basic and advanced mead formulations. We'll see you guys next week.